Welcome to the Career Conversations podcast brought to you by Hunter Recruitment Group. I'm your host, Craig McGregor. And today we have an amazing podcast guest, Lisa Harvey-Smith. Lisa is the Australian Government Women in STEM Ambassador and Professor. She's a keynote speaker of well-renowned. She's an author with six popular books, and she's an astrophysicist. You're wondering, how do you become an astrophysicist and an ambassador in STEM? Well, this is the podcast for you. It's a great podcast where we really dive deep into her passion for gazing up into the sky and taking that passion as a small girl and making it a hobby and then turning that into a career. It's a really great career arc that we follow through academia and then into her professional career as we speak now. She's taken advantage of opportunities that have come her way throughout her career, and I encourage anyone who's thinking about what do I do next, or how do I start my career, or I really want to follow in my passion. Well, Lisa's really inspirational in telling her story. So sit back and enjoy our career conversation with Lisa Harvey-Smith. So welcome to the Career Conversations podcast, Lisa Harvey-Smith.
Thanks, Craig. Nice to be here.
Yeah, and so this is the first one we've done for a while via Teams. We're usually doing these face-to-face, but you're down in Hobart, is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Excellent. So let's start today's conversation. Tell us a little bit about your background and how you started your career.
Well, I guess it started like most kids. You have interests, don't you? And you think, oh, I want to be an astronaut, or I want to be a dinosaur, or whatever. Whatever it is, zookeeper. Kids have funny ideas. And look, I had a few ideas around what I might want to do. Sports, I wanted to be an Olympian, a football player. I wanted to be all sorts of things. Police officer at one point. My dad quickly dissuaded me from that. But
stereotypical. Most kids are the same.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. It's careers basically you're familiar with. You can see them on TV or in books or people in the community. And look, I didn't know any real scientists. I've never heard of a real scientist apart from the famous ones like Isaac Newton and, Einstein and people like this. So it was a funny interest. I guess it started with my dad and I looking at the night sky, age 12. And I just sort of fell in love with astronomy. I really, really, it sort of caught my fascination. It was something you could do practically. It wasn't a sort of passive thing where you just read about it in books. You could literally go outside and look at the stars. So astronomy became my passion. And, I read loads and loads of books about it. I tried to watch any TV shows that came up. There weren't many, to be honest. But then I joined my local astronomical society. And this is a group of slightly odd people who meet every month and talk about space. And they had professional astronomers come.
How old were you when you joined the club?
Oh, God, I think I was about 12 or 13. It was quite young. And most of the people there were honestly in their 50s or 60s at least, some older. But I found them really
welcoming. What did they think about having a 12-year-old? You found them welcoming?
Yeah, they were great. They loved it because, obviously they were worried they'd all die out.
Yeah.
And the hobby would die with them. But, it's great to kind of, that's something that excites me now, inspiring young people, because you're trying to create this sort of, this idea in young people that there's more to the world than what you see every day. And I think that's a lovely idea. And that really caught me. So, yeah, I started studying astronomy and, doing my own research and reading books and books and books. And then I did my first exam in astronomy. I sort of taught myself because I'd left school at 11 years old and I was teaching myself at home. So I kind of got to study the things I was interested in rather than following a strict curriculum. And that was, I guess, one of the elements that helped me to study something a bit unusual, like astrophysics.
So step me through that. So was it homeschooling? Were your parents in control of that, or how did that work?
Yeah, no, my mum was a head teacher at the local primary school. So I'd gone to that school. It's just a regular public school. It's a beautiful little school with 75 kids, very small. And then I left school at 11, due to go to high school, like all my friends. But I visited the high school and I found it a little bit confronting, I guess. They were very gender segregated. girls had to do certain sports and they couldn't do football and things. I was interested in cricket and woodwork and metalwork, and it was very, very sort of old-fashioned. So my dad being stay-at-home dad, which was unusual at the time, and reading a lot of books about education and being interested in things like the Montessori type of education, where you kind of let kids do what they're interested in, he said, well, if you want, you can learn at home. My dad wasn't a trained teacher. He doesn't have any qualifications, but he said, you can learn at home. We can get you the books that you need and, you know, try and help you do the activities that you need. And I chose that path, and my brother and sister also chose that path. So we all learnt at home. We weren't taught. We never had a lesson, sit down lesson. Mm-hmm. I didn't work. I tried to learn German with my dad. We just fought like cat and dog. So we just left it at that, and I sort of followed the things I was interested in. So I studied all sorts of things, from music to sports to philosophy, history, astronomy, poetry. I just did what I was excited by, and I found that
self-learning really
great. It was autonomous learning, I guess, or I think they call it unschooling as well, where you don't go to school, but you're not sort of taught as if you're in school. It's probably not for everyone, but it certainly worked for me.
So if we move forward in time, you've got some great qualifications, tertiary qualifications. How did not going to school impact your ability to get into university?
Yeah, interesting. So I knew, because I really loved astronomy and I wanted to become an astronomer as I got more and more involved in that hobby, I suppose, when I was a kid. I looked into, and I talked to the professional astronomers who came along to our local astronomy group. I said, how do you get into doing this as a career? Because I had no idea. You don't see a lot of scientists wandering around the neighborhood normally that you get to talk to. So I was very lucky that I got to sort of ask those questions, and they said, well, you need to go to university and study physics and astronomy and maths and all these things. And then I kind of went back and researched, you know, what do you have to do to get into uni? And you had to do A-levels in the UK, so it's like the HSC, a similar year 12 qualifications, and I did that. But to get into the college to do that, I had to get GCSEs, which is the exams you do when you're 16 in the UK. So I just worked backwards, and I taught myself for my GCSEs, got into college, and then I did my year 12 exams and got into uni. So I kind of just had to do a bit of research and a bit of study myself.
Yep. So you could find the pathway to get those grades that were required to get into the university course that you wanted to do.
That's it. I must say, though, I did the bare minimum exams I had to do. They said you have to get into college, you have to do 5 qualifications. So I did 5, because I didn't want to waste a lot of time doing sort of 12 different subjects to exam level. I'd rather read books and be following my interests rather than sort of structuring it in that formal way.
At the time in the UK, was it similar to how it works here in Australia now, where the different courses have different ATAR levels or scores that you have to achieve to get into those? So was astronomy a certain target or there was a grade that you had to reach?
No, well, it's a bit different in the UK. You do far fewer subjects, so you specialise a lot earlier in the UK. So with your A-levels, with your year 12 exams, you only do 3 subjects normally. So I chose maths, physics and chemistry to get into an astrophysics degree.
Because
they align, And basically, if you did history, French and physics, you wouldn't get into a degree in that, because the history and French don't count, you know, they don't help you. So I think the universities in the UK are a bit more stringent on exactly what narrow subjects they want to get into that particular discipline. So you kind of have to choose a bit earlier. I think in Australia, you have a bit more choice because you can study lots of subjects. And as long as you've got particular prerequisites and a good, you know, good enough ATAR or equivalent, then you can get into the universities. But in the UK, you really have to specialise early. It's a little bit different.
Yeah. And so tell me, because if you think about it, young person leaving high school, heading into university, there are certain degrees which can be not narrow, but very specific, like nursing, you're going to be a nurse. Business, however, you could be, you know, in HR, marketing, accounting. There's a little bit more diversity of roles, I suppose, supply and demand of employment opportunities. Tell me about astronomy and astrophysics. I would think that that is a pathway that isn't overly abundant in supply and demand of roles. And what was your thoughts entering it like that?
Yeah, no, that was a really important part of my thinking, actually. As I went in, I asked quite a lot of people, well, I definitely want to be an astronomer, but should I study astronomy or astrophysics, which are basically the same thing? It's just two words for the same thing. Or should I study physics more broadly? And then that would give me a broader range of options, go into medical physics, or you can go into the defense, or, you know, all sorts of areas, even some parts of engineering would overlap. But, you know, I was pretty sure of what I wanted to do, but I did do a physics degree in the end, and I just did my specialization really in astronomy and astrophysics. But it was quite a broad degree with maths and physics and chemistry and lasers and all sorts of stuff, quantum mechanics. But it was hard. But it was a worry that, you know, if you specialize too early, you won't get into these roles. However, now, as you know, 20, 30 years later, you sort of realize, well, actually, even if you study astronomy and astrophysics or something specific, whatever it is, you can often translate that into other disciplines, because, you know, even one degree that sounds specific has a broad range of different elements to it.
Yeah, 100%.
And you know, even with that, you know, I see a lot of astronomy graduates now who go into data science. They work for Atlassian, or they work for Google, or they go and work in finance or business. So yeah, it's a really interesting choice, and it's you're never certain, because people do have prejudices about degrees and what particular degree. It might be in a job advert, you must have a marketing business administration degree to do this. And in fact, if you thought about it and you looked at someone's career path, they might have all the right skills and experiences without that qualification. So I think that's on people in recruitment to actually think really carefully what they're actually asking for.
And you're preaching to the converted there. I'm big on that. But it's more about, I wanted to get more in the headspace of the 18-year-old going, oh, am I limiting myself here, or do I need a more diverse? And I think the answer that you've given is really eye-opening for our younger listeners that, even if you go down path A, the skills and the qualifications that you get will open doors in path B. So it's not as narrowing as you think. So go and do what you're passionate about. Go and do what you're really, really excited about, and it may lead and open more doors. So, it's a good thing, but scary as a 17, 18-year-old.
When you don't know if you're going to make
finish
it
school
in
and that's right. So when you finished your degree, what was next? From a work perspective, did you jump into work, or did you continue to study?
Yeah, well, I knew the sort of traditional pathway again. At the time, you don't know what you're doing, so you kind of ask older people, and that's a good thing to do. You also got to use your own mind as well. But it was very clear that if I wanted to become a research scientist, which I did, I would have to do a PhD, so a doctorate. So I was really keen to get into one of those. I mean, it's a 3-year degree at least, and unlike an undergraduate degree, it's really a lot of research. So it's almost like going to work. You learn the research skills that you need, you write research papers, you actually generate new knowledge and discover stuff that no one's ever found before, which is really, really exciting. So
tell me about the process of that application. Is it how deep is that to be accepted into a doctorate?
Yeah. It's not the important thing. It's not just based on grades. That's the really important thing. So, you know, maybe at high school you're taught, oh, you've got to get high ATAR, or got to get the best grades. Actually, when you go a bit further and into kind of the career world, what matters a bit more is your ability to communicate and explain your knowledge, experience and passion, and to demonstrate to someone you'll be a good person to work with. There'll also be an element of having work experience as well. So if you spent your whole degree just drinking or whatever it is and just studying, that's not going to cut it. So you've got to kind of really push yourself into places where you might be able to get a bit of work experience and make some connections. And I did that in my third year at undergrad at uni. I actually begged and begged and begged all my lecturers to try and find me a professional scientist to work with in the summer. So it was a summer break. I was like, I've got to get some work experience. And I was very lucky in the end. I pushed and pushed and I got a work experience in Germany. And I went there for 6 weeks and I worked with the Max Planck Institute for Radio Astronomy in Bonn. And I ended up being a radio astronomer because of those connections, that experience. And, you know, when I got to my interview and my application for a PhD, I could say, well, I've done my summer studentship at the Max Planck Institute, which is very well known and very well renowned. And I've done this research, and I was able in my interview to actually talk in depth about that research. All the other students might have said, well, I got 98% in my exams. Like, well, who cares? Good on you. But it's written stuff that you've remembered on a piece of paper. That's not work skills. That's not work experience. And that's not connections and other things that matter to people in the world of work. So whether or not we like that fact, you know, a bit of connections and a bit of, I guess, having immersed yourself in the real world of work really helps.
Yeah, that's interesting. I always say to young kids when they come in, or parents, friends, or have their kids come and have a chat to me about career and stuff when they're in year 11, 12, or even just left school. And here in Australia, we get this little blue folder with our HSC and our results in it. And I always jokingly say, I can't remember the last time I actually asked to see that. Because once you finish it, it's irrelevant.
Not interested. Yeah, not interested. You know,
so very similar to what you were just talking about.
Yeah, when I was hiring, you know, for summer studentships at CSIRO, when I was working there as a research scientist, did not look at the grades. I don't care. I don't care about your ability to remember things and regurgitate them. I don't care about that. I care about why you are interested in working with me and what you bring to the table.
Yeah. So before we snake our way through your career, let's do something a little bit different. Let's go to today. Tell me about what you're doing today.
All right. Today or generally today?
No, generally what you've been doing in the STEM stuff.
Yeah, so currently it's an unusual job and people often say, what the hell's that? But I'm the Australian government's Women in STEM ambassador. So it's a position that was created by the Australian government in 2018 and it'd never been created before. I mean, it was a new thing, it was a new initiative. And they said, well, we've got all this interest in science, technology, engineering and maths and an understanding of how that's important for the economy and for developing industries and all that jazz. You know, STEM is something a lot of people talk about. And it is important that we have a diverse workforce in STEM so we can get lots of people, homegrown talent, as well as people who come in from overseas to help us build up industry and support new technologies. That's obviously self-evident. That's going to help everyone in Australia because they, you know, we're creating things like amazing medical breakthroughs and things that help us in our everyday lives. But one of the big barriers to that is gender inequality and having barriers to particular groups, a lot of which we talk about women, but also other underrepresented groups in STEM. So that's kind of hindering our progress as a nation. So they said, let's hire someone who knows about this and who can help to alleviate that problem, break down the barriers and increase the participation in STEM in Australia. So that's what I did. And since 2018, I've been working on this problem. I've worked through grants from the Department of Industry and the federal government. And I hold that funding through the University of New South Wales, where I'm based. And my team is fantastic. They're researchers, they're social scientists, they're gender experts, they're communications experts, education experts. And we run loads of different programs. We run research programs, advocacy, and we try and get young people to understand the broad range and diversity of career pathways into STEM as well.
Excellent. So something that's relatively new, do you think if we go back to the start of our conversation when you, you know, made the decision to self-educate and one of those reasons was the opportunities for young women at school were narrow and gender specific, does that build into why you're passionate about what you do today?
Absolutely. My mum was a great feminist. She really was. And my dad. he's pretty, you know, he's pretty solid feminist as well. So I think I came from that background, you know, where our family was had the traditional roles turned on its head. My dad was staying at home, my mum was working, and I really always felt that everyone should have the opportunity to do what they love and are good at, or even if they're not good at it, let's be honest, just get that opportunity. And you know what, I think that's always stayed with me. And, you know, through my career being a scientist, but also caring about social justice, I think it's a nice sort of nexus of those two things.
We still have a long way to go, but do you think it has changed? Like, if I reflect on, I've got three daughters, and I'm a bit passionate about women's advancing through the workplace and opportunities, and I love going to their school presentations each year, mainly because the girls are champions in those areas. Like I love it when they'll year seven's first place award for woodwork, young girl, you know, year eight first place for metalwork, young girl, and I'm just thinking, this is awesome. So I just reflect on a long time ago when I went to school, that would never have been the case. It just, like you say, they're just, I don't think those opportunities or pathways were naturally there, whereas today young girls seem to get the opportunity to do some broader things, and programs like what you're in charge of are giving those kids opportunities to see more. So can you see that in the marketplace? Is there success coming through?
Definitely. We you know, we have a lot of work to do in gender equality in the world more broadly, and in the economy and women's safety. But in STEM particularly, you know, we get data from the Australian government every year from the Australian Bureau of Statistics and other sort of data collection services. We can see that in at year 12 in Australia, we've got gender parity in people who choose maths and science now. Which is terrific. Sort of lagging in engineering and computing, and there's a few reasons for that. I think we see a lot of visibility of science and maths in the curriculum, but we don't really name engineering, and we don't really see enough of computing in the curriculum. So I think those are areas we need to work on. But we've reached parity, and more young women than men do science degrees now in Australia as well. And the other thing is, since I began this role in 2018, the number of women working in STEM qualified industries has increased by 38%, which is massive. So we're definitely seeing an expansion, but it really does depend on the prevailing economic conditions, what's happening with childcare, what's happening with parental leave, and who can actually take parental leave and who's encouraged to do so. So there's a lot of sort of moving parts, but we're definitely seeing progress.
And the funding that funds your program and others in STEM, have you seen that since 2018 increase? Is the government's focus to try and generate A, more roles in STEM, but then B, look at the gender equality of those STEM programs?
Yeah, since 2018, so my initiative is funded by the Australian government, so the Department of Industry, Science and Resources, and our funding has just increased up to this point. It actually ends in May this year, so we don't know what will come next. That hasn't yet been announced. So, yeah, I'm hopeful that this will continue, and that there will be something in the future that really helps us to build on the gains that we've made so far.
Okay. Tell me, as an ambassador, what's the main purpose and part of your day-to-day role?
Wow, there's a lot. I think me personally, as the ambassador now, I have a really big team that's leading research and creating information for the sector, tools and resources for workplaces to make policy and program improvements. We've got a program called Future You, which helps inspire young people and see career pathways that might be things they weren't familiar with. But in a sort of personal capacity as the ambassador now, a lot of what I do is speaking to people and advocacy and sharing the data, sharing the information on really what works. So all that great research is being done so that I can share that, and we can share it collectively with teachers, with the public, with parents, you know, with universities and workplaces, and so that everyone has the tools that they need to try and make a difference in their sphere of influence. So, you know, we can all talk wax lyrical about the big problems in the world and this US president should be doing this or the UN should be doing that. But, you know, what can we actually change in our world? that's what matters. You know, how can I talk to my son and my daughter differently? How can I run my classroom activities differently, or whatever our sphere of influence is? So I think that's really important. I do a lot of talking. I hopefully do a bit of listening too, but I do like to share the information that we've gathered for our activities over the past 5.5 years with as many audiences as possible, to try and help advise the government, to advise the sector, whether that's companies or education or whatever, to try and make changes and make sure that every young person has the opportunities that they deserve.
So how far different is this from astrophysics?
It's harder. Do you know what? People, dealing with people and working with people and systems is difficult. Astrophysics is, I don't know, it's one of these things where you can dive in, you can sort of come up with a problem and write a little proposal to use a telescope to look at a star trillions of kilometers away, and you know, you can look at the chemicals in the gas cloud surrounding the star and you can find out X, Y, Z. You write a paper and you share that with your peers. It's simple in some ways. It's neat and tidy, but people and systems and society are very messy and complicated, and it's very different. And I've really learned a lot from social scientists and education researchers and the broad range of people from business and government and other sectors. And it shows the complexity of the real world, and that's different from pure sciences, which sort of try and ignore the complexity of the real world, I guess, and just look at the things in terms of numbers. Useful in the sciences, but if you want to actually get findings and use them in the real world, then it's a whole different process. And that's why I think I've developed my communication skills, because you really find that that is the key piece of the puzzle that helps you to create change.
Yeah, okay. So now, step me through, draw a line for me. How does an astrophysicist become an ambassador for women in STEM?
I guess you just get an email and someone says, hey, I see, you know, you've worked in astrophysics, so you're a STEM professional. I've done research for 15 years in astrophysics, different institutes around the world, worked for a long time in Australia on big projects and building capacity for the future, new telescopes, things like that. And a lot of communication of science, but also I'd worked on gender equity problems in my sort of, in a voluntary capacity, I suppose. I joined my professional body, the Astronomical Society of Australia, and become the chair of the Women in Astronomy chapter. Done a lot of work developing a program called the Pleiades Awards, which is named after the constellation of the Seven Sisters. In the night sky, and it's sort of symbolic of the women in the universe, and the fact that they deserve an equal opportunity to study astrophysics. And the program is still going today. It's very successful, and it helps guide organizations that hire astronomers that have astronomy institutes like universities and CSIRO and things like that, and it helps them to guide them through a gender equity journey in the workplace, so they look at their policies and practices and things and make it better for everyone. So I kind of done that work in a voluntary capacity. I've done a lot of speaking about gender equity in science, and that has piqued some interest from the government who wanted to set up this this program, and so I had a couple of interviews with government ministers, which was a new experience. And obviously I said the right things, and yeah, they offered me the role. It was a difficult decision actually as to whether to take it on, because it's a very different pathway from just doing research. And often the old adage, you know, is that once you get out of research, it's very hard to get back in. I think there's a lot of truth in that. But
is
to be honest,
true, because you find a different path? Like, do people want to go back?
I think a lot of people do want to go back, and I think again in recruiting people are quite narrow in,
yeah,
you know, you have to have done this path, and I think we need to get our minds away from that. You know, but I think there's always a way to shift your path. So I think the importance in that is keeping your options open and keeping your bridges strong, and keeping your connections strong with the industry that you're interested in pursuing next. So that's, yeah, but from a personal perspective, I've found my career to help build up my other skills outside the basic core ones that you might expect in a science career. I've done management training, I've done now company director training, you know, I've managed large budgets, and it just sort of it expands your skill sets and expands your opportunities way beyond where you might have thought they lay.
And also, so you know, you mentioned that increase in communication skills, but there's a, you know, in your background you've had a couple of times working in TV as a presenter,
those
sorts
of
things. Yeah, well, that's again not stereotypical scientists doing that sort of stuff, is it?
It isn't. No, it's weird. I said at the start of this chat that when I was 12, I read every book that I could get my hands on and tried to watch any TV programs about astronomy. There wasn't much back then because there were only three or four channels on the TV. Didn't have all this streaming stuff. But yeah, I was sort of looked up to people who communicated science and ended up doing a lot of that. I was a presenter on ABC's Stargazing Live and a few international documentaries and bits and bobs. I talk to the media a lot about science because I find it fun and enjoyable, and I love sharing. But it's certainly a skill, and you have to develop it because you're frankly terrible at it at first. And it's, you know, taken me, I don't know, probably be doing it 20 years now.
Have been, again, another skill that's being built alongside your research skills to allow you to be in the position that you are today.
That's it. Yeah, I definitely think, I mean, I wouldn't have got this role as Women in STEM Ambassador if I hadn't developed those communication skills and I hadn't volunteered my time talking to the media, talking to schools and, you know, conferences that weren't inside my realm of research. And actually got a bit of pushback from that whilst I was in a research focused role. You know, some people, even my managers at the time, were saying, well, why are you wasting your time with this? And that's really not the attitude to have, because I think if we're looking broadly at our careers as developing new skills and knowledge, any new skills and knowledge are going to be useful.
As well, you're promoting the space, the sector, the research, that people would be positive about that.
And research doesn't happen in a bubble, does it? Someone's got to fund it, and that's the taxpayers often. So people deserve to know what's happening with their money. And I think, you know, that's one of my joys throughout my career, of actually sharing that with people.
What about you're in this role now, and you probably hopefully have some insight for us. STEM is increasing. What about your part of STEM? Astrophysics, astronomy, is the supply of kids coming through and choosing that vocation growing or declining?
It is. Oh my God, it's growing massively. And do you know what I think? You know, there are the kind of the cool sciences that people talk about on the TV, and there's, you know, dinosaurs, and there's you know, maybe sharks and diseases and astronomy. And there might be some others, but, you know, there's a lot of great science and medical research we never hear about. There's a lot of fascinating social sciences we never hear about. But astronomy is just one of these things that kids like and is in the national psyche, is in the global psyche.
Yep.
People write songs about it. People create art about it. It's just, it's just everywhere. So I think we're lucky as astronomers, and also a lot of astronomers in my generation have become science communicators as well as their research roles. So because of that, I think we've got a huge number of astrophysicists. I wouldn't say too many, but perhaps a lot of people graduating are disappointed that there aren't as many roles as they would hope. And they have to go into something else, and that they have very fulfilling careers. But I think there isn't always the match between the number of intake at university and then the graduates and then the actual availability of research roles that people hope for. So we do have to be a little bit careful in how we communicate the career pathways again, because there are so many roles in STEM and in astrophysics, in my case, that don't just take that traditional pathway. You can communicate science, you can help develop the infrastructure and the capacity that are required by science without necessarily having to do that role.
Yeah, it's really interesting stuff. I love the supply and demand of it all as well, the employment economics, if we reflect back to your study and when you were doing your degree and opportunities and even research, the increase in availability of technology to be able to increase research and where people do that research would have changed drastically. Someone living in Maitland, for example, could do astrophysics today out of the University of Sydney via remote learning that 30 years ago was probably not an opportunity. So those sorts of things increase the opportunity for young people to be able to do that. And I think the mind shift of young kids are changing around the economics of where they live, that, here where we live was very much for the last 30, 40 years mining dominated. So the kids that may have done astrophysics or some other STEM have more than likely gone into engineering or a trade in the Hunter Valley to generate a good job opportunity, whereas having opportunities to remotely work out of Maitland and work on amazing national or global projects, that's awesome.
Yeah, I'm a big proponent for remote learning and work wherever possible. It's a game changer, and if we don't use it, then we're doing ourselves a huge disservice as a country that is so geographically distributed, and pretty much everyone lives in a few urban centres and the surrounds, and then there's thousands of k's of far fewer people. It doesn't make any sense for us to just advertise roles and opportunities in one particular geographical location. It's crazy.
So I usually don't do much research for these conversations. I love to just wing it and snake my way through someone's career. But I'm really fascinated. You're an author. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I know.
Tell me about writing a
book. I know.
Book.
God. Again, wasn't necessarily something I planned. So I grew up reading a lot, but I didn't write a lot. I didn't really like writing, and I don't have any qualifications in English or anything like that. So I don't really know what an adjective is or anything like that. But I kind of, from reading a lot, I think I've just absorbed that kind of inner voice of, how to explain things. No interest in writing a book until, I guess, I finished my PhD, and there was a competition in the New Scientist magazine for postgrad students, and said, explain your PhD, write, 800 words, blah, blah, blah. So I had a go. I sent it in, and about 2 months later, I got a letter saying, I'm sorry, we've ceased this competition. None of the entries were up to standard. Absolutely couldn't write about science. So I guess I did a lot of explaining verbally. I did a lot of talks in schools. I did a lot of media interviews, and eventually got better at it and became someone who was commentating on TV and things like that years later. After I was presenting on Stargazing Live on the ABC, I received an email out of the blue from a publisher, and they said, would you like to write a book? And clearly a publisher's motivation is to make money, find someone who had some sort of profile within the field, and then hope that they could write a book and then, obviously make that a success. I was, wow, yeah, that sounds great. I was really excited. The thought of being, again, someone who can inspire young people, older people, anyone really, was something exciting for me. So I actually just jumped in and did it. And I wrote When Galaxies Collide, my first book, in 2018. It took me 3 months full time, long service leave I actually took to write that book. And it was hard at first. I was writing it in a sort of an academic style. The poor publisher had to, hammer me into shape a little bit. But once I got the hang of the voice and just relaxing and not trying to use fancy language, I'm trying to explain things in a way that people could really understand, like a conversation, how you would explain it in the pub or, at a barbecue or something.
What we need. Romantic picture that we all think about, that author sitting by a lake typing up their memoir or their book. Is that true? Is that how it happened?
Dining table, uncomfortable chair, scary deadlines, not much money. Yep. That's how it really works.
Yep. Excellent.
Yeah. So, yeah, so I launched that book. It was really cool. It's for adults and I was so excited. And then we did a kids book and really just went really well, went global, got translated into Chinese. And, you know, it's just been really exciting since then, focusing largely on kids books. And
excellent.
I've actually written 11 now. They haven't all wow. come out yet, but yeah, I'm up to 11. So that all happened very quickly and unexpectedly. And it's a really nice way to, I guess, spend my evenings and weekends beyond work.
Excellent. Good stuff. Well, it's such a successful career path that you've had. We have one formal question on our podcast and we have a time machine. If we could put you in the time machine and rewind the clock to 21-year-old Lisa, given what you know now, what advice would you give her?
Ooh. Drink more water.
Yeah.
No, but seriously, in the vein of career, I suppose, career advice, I would just say don't fail to advocate for yourself. Like I at that age, I had an abundance of confidence. I think sometimes that can wane as you get a bit older and you start getting bashed about by life. You know, keep advocating for yourself. Make sure you're on the track that you want to be on. And if you don't like where you are, leave. You know, some workplaces can't be fixed, but you have a lot of choices in life. You have choices. So keep learning. Keep never pretend that you know things as well. That's another important one. Keep yourself honest and you'll do right.
I love it. I do a lot of career transition work with people that are being made redundant and helping them transition into their next career. And I have this little program that I show them about finding their dream job. And some people like what I say, some people don't. But I say, if you're not doing what you're passionate about, if you're not in your dream job, then you're getting life wrong.
Mm.
We get one shot at this. If you're 40, 50 hours a week doing something that you hate, at age 65, 70, you're going to look back and go, why?
So did I waste my time?
Getting that right and being passionate about what you do, critical. So I think you're on the right path there. So excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Lisa. It was a privilege to have you on our podcast and really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Craig. It's been great talking to you.
A big thank you to today's guest, Lisa Harvey-Smith, and what an amazing career arc that we just got to hear all about. Inspirational. If you'd like to learn more about Lisa, you can visit her website, lisaharveysmith.com, or you can go to womeninstem.org to find out more about the Australian Government Women in STEM Ambassador and the programs that they operate. Again, thank you, Lisa, for your inspiration and for sharing with us your career. If you liked today's podcast, I encourage you to go on to iTunes, Apple Podcasts and give us a rating or subscribe and follow our podcast at your favorite podcast sites. Until next time, I'm Craig McGregor and this podcast was brought to you by Hunter Recruitment Group.